Hey everybody, welcome to Emmaus Way. Feel free to come in and get settled in the circle today. Really excited, we've got Ben Haas speaking in our Why I Am series, and having a chance to kind of sit in on this one in the preparation was fantastic. So let me, we're going to read, if you'll look in your handout, I'm going to read our call to gather, and it's entitled Fundamentalism. And as we've been doing this summer, a lot of us have been talking about our roots in faith, regardless of where they come from. And Ben has, and some of you know Ben, has a pretty amazing story of a really uniquely fundamentalist upbringing. And so he's going to talk about how that upbringing shapes him. But this is called Fundamentalism. Let me read it for you. Because the eye has a short shadow, or it is hard to see over heads in the crowd. If everyone else seems smarter, but you need your own secret. If mystery was never your friend, if one way could satisfy the infinite heart of the heavens, if you liked the king on his golden throne more than the villagers carrying baskets of lemons, if you wanted to be sure his guards would admit you to the party, the boy with the broken pencil scrapes his little knife against the lead, turning and turning it as a point emerges from the wood again. If he would believe his life is like that, he would not follow his father into war. And I think we have community song or greeting these days. Joel, you're going to lead us from our crew behind me here. Guys, I need to figure out where to get one of these dinosaur shirts. Those are very, very, very cool. Thank you guys for doing that. So just briefly, most of you guys know this, Emmaus Way is a community of friends that we gather each week in this space on Sunday evenings and around the table to, in many ways, live a life in the gospel. That for us, is as we understand it, is an opportunity to live in God's hope, live in God's redemption in this space, in this community, kind of in our broader space. And we see each other as absolutely critical in our ability to do that. None of us have this imagination that we're living into faith alone, but we're living into faith together, resting on each other's strengths, bringing our weaknesses to that, bringing our hopes and dreams and visions. And Emmaus Way is truly all about that. And we also are excited. Our Sunday gathering is part of our life together, but we have lots of other stuff that connects us, home groups and a variety of kind of public space gatherings that people hang out in, like a Thursday night pub group. But if you're interested in one of these spaces and don't know what they are or whatever, you could catch me or catch Molly and we can fill you in on those things. But I wanted to pause for just one more second and see if there's any announcements that we have. I have one, but are there any others? So next week, there is a really big, we think, there's a negotiation going on with our partner Durham Can and affordable housing here in the area. And kind of the prize is now before us. We have taken two spaces and gotten them committed to housing, affordable workforce housing, the Jackson Street property over here by the bus station, and hopefully a couple of lots over by Health Services and First Presbyterian and St. Phillips. But there's if you guys know Fayetteville Street, there's a 20-acre property by Umstead and Fayetteville that is where the old projects were. If you drive by there, it literally, we've used the term blighted or war zone, but it's literally just foundations from the projects. And it's 20 acres will provide space for a great deal of public and affordable housing. The people who have that land right now are in in default of a contract. They were supposed to build affordable housing within 10 years. We're coming up on 10 years. And so our next push is to urge the city to start legal action against this company. It's a very large company, so that Durham Housing Authority will buy it back for about $4 million. There's a lot of people in Durham that are working hard, denominations, communities of faith, to accumulate money that's a part of, to be a part of that $4 million buy. We also have had a guarantee. We're not publicizing this as much, but self-help is guaranteed a $4 million loan to the city at no interest to buy that. So the money is in hand, but we are going to hold a major press conference, and we're excited. There's about 150 people in that neighborhood, led by two churches, Monument of Faith and First Chronicles, and it's a historic black middle-class community, and they are very excited about seeing this whole property change. And so what we're hoping to do is get about another 150 people to join that 150 to kind of speak, hold a big press conference. City Council will be there, the mayor will be there. So there's a little bit of a negotiation about that date, but right now it's July 27th at 5:30, meaning like a hard 5:30 start. So we're trying to get 10 people from Emmaus Way out there. One of the things I would also say, if you have kids and your kids have never been a part of kind of a public action, you wanted to explain to them what it is, that counts as well. It's a really good time to take kids and stuff. So I will alert us again next Sunday, but right now it's 5:30, July 27th. So anyway, well, it's good to see everybody here. And Ben, I think you're going to lead us in passing the peace tonight.
Yeah. You ask a fundamentalist to pass the peace, you're asking for it. But no, I thought that, like, yeah, this is going to be a lot of sharing tonight, but I wanted to like frame the space. Tim took my poem. Molly sent me a bunch of poems this week, and I wanted to put this one in my voice because, yeah, it's just an odd task to take on to talk about your fundamentalist heritage, and this poem really sort of marked it for me. So the choice to stand for once outside my faith, to steady it, caught and squirming on a stick, up to the mind's inviting light, and name it for all its faults and facets, or keep waiting to be claimed in it. That hit me. That's what I'm going to try and do tonight. And I apologize in advance for all, yeah, all the random stories and, like, you know, a few just taking you into a world that's just very strange. Maybe it's not as strange as I think, but I suspect it's pretty strange. But in any case, I'm glad you're here to listen. Please pass the peace of Christ to each other and grab some snacks. I'll be back in a couple of minutes to talk about my fundamentalism. So, welcome back. My name is Ben, and I am a fundamentalist. Hi, Ben. Come on. So I'm going to try, this is a good idea, whoever put this mic here like this, so hopefully it can work. So there's no proper way to start something like this than acknowledge just how odd the task is that I've taken on. Fundamentalism is an odd label to claim, much less to try and reclaim. But in this series about dancing with the ones that brought us to the party of faith, fundamentalists are my people, and if dancing sounds like a really poorly chosen metaphor, in terms of people that think dancing is quite literally of the devil, the more I've thought about it, there's probably not a much better way to describe my journey of faith over the last decade than to say that I'm still trying uncomfortably to strike up a dance with the very folks who instilled my lifelong discomfort with dancing. And we don't really know the same steps or music, and it's exactly as awkward as you might expect, and it's probably painful for everyone else to watch, but I hear the music and they invited me, so we dance awkwardly. And there'll be no actual dancing tonight, but I do hope that I can take you just far enough down the rabbit hole of what feels like a rabbit hole of red clay fundamentalism of my childhood that you'll have some sense of how truly impactful and all-encompassing it really was for me then and since, and why I'd even bother to still be grappling with that personal history and its lingering implications. So, but before I get into that, I do want to acknowledge that fundamentalism is a big phenomenon. It's a big word. It's an ism. And, of course, my story or no story can really encompass a word or a concept like that. In part, as this community for 8 years, I know I got some people out here who would, there they are, yeah, who have some fundamentalist cred of their own. And so I want to throw out a question to you. What does fundamentalism call up for you? An experience, an association, a definition that seems pertinent? What do you say?
The touchstone experience for me growing up as a fundamentalist was when Will and I were high school sweethearts, and he attended a Baptist church, and I would take turns attending church together because we were good Christian boyfriend and girlfriend. But I had a friend in my church who I looked up to very much, who took me out to coffee one Sunday after we'd been dating for several months and said that my salvation was in jeopardy because I was choosing to attend a Baptist church every other week. And that if I continue...
That's what I was doing.
Yeah. If I continue to do that, and especially since they had a woman pastor, that was particularly damning to my soul. So if I continue to do that, yeah. my salvation was in question. And that for me was the moment where I was just like, I don't buy this anymore. And that was sort of my downhill slide, kind of away from the church. But that was sort of that moment for me where I wondered, what is this?
Yeah, we both made very bad choices, Chelsea. We're damned. Yeah, Tim.
I think for me, now we were Baptist, Southern Baptist, rural fundamentalists. For us, it was a posture of defensiveness. Always ready to defend something and always on guard because, there were a lot of people to be nervous about. People went to college. People who, all the moral type of things, but there was a preparation to defend against multiple fronts that could be shifted. Being my age in the 60s, it was a racial front. I don't know if you guys would have remembered this or heard this, but in the late 60s, Black Christians were just going to churches to see who would serve them communion or would let them in the door. It was a very common phenomenon, and we would have been on guard such that something like that would never happen. Now, as for Will or Molly, female, that was
beyond the pale.
Beyond the pale. That wasn't what happened.
Yeah, I think that notion of defensiveness, the first place I really encountered the term fundamentalism was when I read George Marsden in college, and his, what I think is a pretty good line to describe this sweeping tendency in American religious history is, a fundamentalist is an evangelical who is angry about something. Most of the ones I've met kind of are. So, anyone else? One more, maybe? Brandon.
So, teaching summer school, American religion, and just taught fundamentalism this week. And the thing that I think is that I love to use for teaching that is Randall Ballmer's chapter about the Word of Life summer camp and the Adirondacks. And he describes this sort of tense scene where kids have been sort of worn out through a long week of late night singing, and they're all around the campfire, and each one is deciding what they're going to devote to God for the year. And what they need to devote to God are their AC/DC tapes that they're throwing into the fire, or that skirt that's a little too short. But these markers get thrown into the fire one by one. And for me, I didn't experience it that much in my day-to-day, but I did go to these summer camps that were meant to sort of manufacture religious conversion, but a conversion that was marked by what you were going to do better this coming school year.
Yeah.
And then experiencing sort of the hope of that. I'm going to read my Bible every night. I'm going to do my daily devotions. And then like
God brought it to
three,
pass.
4 weeks into that, when you start slipping, realizing, oh no, you know, I need to get back to summer camp.
You're a backslider then. Yeah. So I think that's great. I mean, Tim and Brandon both give some big contextual things that I would have said. I think I know there's folks like Chelsea. I'm sure we gave Laura Wooten the mic, and she can talk for a half hour with fundamentalist stories of a homeschooled childhood. I mean, there's some markers that I don't have. We weren't homeschooled, right? Like, you know, the racial thing, we kind of pretended that didn't exist, right? Whereas, like, it being very present. So I think that, for me, if fundamentalism is something it's been very clear to take on afterwards, it's like, oh, that's what that was. And I think that it does make a pretty good term to describe this broad orientation, kind of like Tim was talking about, this defensiveness. And to try and build elaborate and insular systems of control and differentiation for making us different than them and keeping them out of us. And that's really true to how I've experienced it. And so I want to acknowledge that I'm going to go down the rabbit hole of my personal thick experience with white, Southern, independent Baptist fundamentalism. But there's probably a lot of more of them out there. And I think even as in our poem introduced in the call to gather, it's a much bigger term even than the American 20th century Christianity that it kind of gets birthed out of. So as to my specific experience, I have spent long enough in this community that I think parts of this won't be new to some of you, and Eway feels like a perfect, maybe the only community in which to tell this story and to tell it well. But I think despite that, it's still a story that feels untold to me, because in a very significant way, in a way I sort of have uncovered in the past couple weeks even, telling it well requires uniting the experience of at least two very different people. Because if you were to ask most anyone from my family or the church I grew up in, the second of Daniel and Marie's four sons is Benjamin. And by third grade, most anyone I knew outside of that called me Ben. And so Ben and Benjamin came to really feel like two pretty different people. And many of you will also know that Benjamin's last name was Haas, but I spent the last decade as Ben Haas. And it sounds really simple and trite, but Amanda's really the only one here who's had the chance to know Benjamin Haas, and that Benjamin Haas felt perfectly safe and comfortable in the fifth pew on the left side of Calvary Baptist Church in Hickory, North Carolina, and still would if he still existed, which thankfully, to my perspective, he doesn't. But my immediate family, in many respects, knows very little about Ben Haas, who's sitting on this stool, to the extent that I doubt most of them would know the name Emmaus Way, much less the fact that I draw income from Emmaus Way. So for me, there's not a better way to get at this anxiety of influence that's defined my story than to say it feels as if it happened to two different people who almost certainly would not get along, and who haven't gotten along in getting me here. And that's maybe an odd way to tell an odd story, but it does feel appropriate and honest. And it feels different than some other ways I've told the story, like the collection of party tricks, like the weird shit that's happened to Ben, or the wrestling match where I get out and I won, or the sob story where look at how hard this is. So I want to try and do something a little different in saying this is what it was. This is what it still is in the fullest form that I can. It's a story about Benjamin Haas and Ben Haas. And that hopefully both of them would feel comfortable calling their own story. And so, in brief, three acts tonight. Where did Benjamin Haas come from? What in the world caused Ben Haas to take his place? How do you fill that space? And what do you do at the end with a life story that's comprised of two different people? This has turned into an Alfred Hitchcock film. So what's the deal with Benjamin Haas? This is Act One. To be fair, he would not take the label fundamentalism. He grew up in Baptist churches that would self-identify as independent, as in totally self-governing and free from corrupting influence of any denomination, and especially the Southern Baptist Convention. And fundamental in that they were grounded in narrowly defined doctrinal fundamentals of the faith that were broadly shared but not really recognized such on the ground in my experience. So independent fundamental Baptist churches, but in practice, I rarely heard those terms used, and the sense was that the churches of my childhood weren't part of a tradition or movement. We, for us, faith was church, as in the church we attended, and for all practical and rhetorical purposes, we were simply ourselves, which meant that we were singular and we were correct, and that's all we needed to be. To the degree, now this sounds weird, but to the degree that I have heard members of my family express a firm belief that anyone in driving distance of our home church who is truly faithful to the Lord would somehow be guided by the Spirit to our specific church. I believe there are people in my family who believe this, at least have, may to this day. And that's in spite of the fact that you can open the phone book. This is a small town in the South, and there were dozens of conservative Baptist options. So that's how specific it felt to us. And my own personal history takes it a little further because faith equaled our church, and it felt as if family equaled church plus that faith. I'm going to fast forward as much as I can, but I do feel like I need to give you some sense of where that comes from. My parents met as first-generation college students at an independent Baptist Bible college called Tennessee Temple University. Anybody? Tennessee Temple? Yeah, there we go.
They used to be our rivals.
Exactly. They are now no longer in existence. They have merged with Piedmont Baptist University of, is it Winston? Exactly. See, we're putting it all together. I grew up with hazy edge stories of these places, sort of like, you know, soft focus stories about the college and the proto megachurch that founded it. If you Google this place, I mean, we're talking 10,000 members in the 60s. It was big. And they started this college to be a kind of mothership of independent Baptist faith, standing strong against the counterculture and Southern Baptists. And that's where my parents met and fell in love and got married. And for my mom, it was very much a second generation tradition because this will put this in my father's words, her father was one of the most consistent people you'll ever meet. As in the kind of consistency that inspires your parishioners to force you out of your small town Baptist pastorate in a story that ends with shotguns and slashed tires. I mean, this man was serious and he got serious responses. So that's the two generations behind me, and I very much came up feeling as if my family was the inner core of the churches we were part in, and that's partly because the first church I remember attending was co-pastored by my father and grandfather. And my mother taught public school, so I spent my first 5 years in the daily care of my maternal grandparents, and we went to mission conferences and revivals during the day, and they witnessed to at least 90% of the fast food workers I've ever seen them encounter. I mean, quite literally. So at about 6 years old, my father he'd been pastoring to some degree. He didn't have a full-time position, but this felt call to ministry led us to North Carolina. And he becomes the minister of music and my mom the church pianist of a small independent Baptist church in Hickory, North Carolina. And to close the circle, this is a church pastored by a college friend of my parents from 20 years prior. So this is all quite small. The confines of obedience in that community were very clear to me. That was my home church for the next 15 years. It's the church I went to college from. If I went back to a church, that's the one I would go to at home. And by our arrival in North Carolina, I'd had these customary markers of a properly church childhood, the sort of, you know, five-year-old conversion experience in Sunday school, etc. But this was the opportunity to really more fully enter me into the practice of faith, because we were a musical family, and I grew up singing in and around my family. And by music, we meant church music, and none of your fancy devilish beats, okay, or praise courses, piano and organ are fine. I was a cute, clever, I think, minister's kid with a good voice. And other people agreed enough that they said, let's get this kid up in front of the church and have him sing, right? Specials, right? This is not special music, but specials. So by age 7 or 8, I was singing regularly on Wednesday night services, and then gradually, as I got less cripplingly nervous, Sunday night and then Sunday morning, you know. And I want to introduce you to the first song of my personal repertoire. Oh, this is not going to be... Yeah. Can you read this? I will sing it. Obedience is the very best way to show that you believe. Anybody? Exactly what the Lord commands, doing it happily. Action is the key, do it immediately. Joy you will receive. Obedience is the very best way to show that you believe. Okay, so this song's done some rounds. It comes out of... Yeah, nice, Gail. It's got a history. It's a common kids' song, particularly in independent Baptist churches, the ones I kind of grew up with. And this is the song... Yeah, this is the first song I sang. And so for me, it felt like this is the opening of my imagination for where I fit in the community of faith. So maybe a quick, like, hot take. If that's the context, what do you make of this? We want to live pure. We want to live clean. Anybody, like...
What are we supposed to say to that?
Okay, I mean, that's fair. It's my song, right? So,
it's funny. I've met with two people, not in Emmaus Way, in entirely different circumstances, who would have grown up in this environment, and they, you know, one of the first things that they used to describe kind of the angst that they've experienced, either in professionally, marriage, otherwise, is what they call purity culture. This idea that you know that a perfect, you know, like, today is the day that I'm going to not sin.
Right.
I'm going to make it till, you know, 9 p.m. Right. Or the idea of, you know, young adulthood of kind of like, you know, a failure means that I'm an impure wife, I'm an impure employee. But this, you know, it was really odd that I ran into two people who used the same language to describe their failures, not being pure.
Yeah, I was
going
to say that. Just lays it all out for you. Like, what do you say to them?
Yeah, that's fair. Emily.
Not to make this about me, but we had a class in college that, like, where they taught us about the worldview triangle, and at the bottom of the triangle was what you valued, and at the top of the triangle was your actions. And if your actions weren't what you said you valued, that meant you didn't actually value those things, right? So if you didn't obey, that meant you didn't actually believe. And that was, like, a scary thing.
If you could have just sang this song as a child, you wouldn't have needed that class, right? I mean, yeah. What, Brett?
It made me think about the Hunger Games and when...
Oh, my.
When PETA, one of the heroes, is captured by the Capitol... and then brainwashed, and then he starts putting him up on TV, and he's trying to convince all of it. He's trying to now, like, you actually sitting up and singing this in front of your church feels like you've been brainwashed. And now you're there using you to brainwash all your friends.
Thank you. I didn't know if anyone would say that, but, like, I definitely had, I mean, you get some weird interactions with, like, your church friends when you start singing this on, like, Sunday night, right? And there was this sense of, like, this is a really crystalline vision of social and religious control. This is me looking back of it. But I do feel like, you know, 8-year-olds are pretty clever. Like, they know what's going on. And there's this passive aggression, right, from the adults programming the child into this, but also from the child who's sending this back at the adults, right? Because how hard is obedience when you're 7 years old, right? Significantly harder if you're just a random working class person in the church. And I think that, yeah, this song and the experience of singing, it really binds this faith, church, family thing together for me. And it throws music in there on top of it as kind of a binding agent, because I had this sense from performances like this, I was intelligent, I was well-mannered, I was the son of white-collar church leadership and a blue-collar church, and I was performing the essential pedagogical ideal. I've been coached by godly parents to articulate and exemplify the outlines of what faithfulness looks like, and I was totally safe and validated inside of that, but obviously open to estrangement and alienation outside of that circle. So it really, looking back, but also, you know, you look at these interactions you had, and you're like, oh, yeah, I don't know how well received that was by everyone. So that's kind of an entree. I think this was one thing that it felt like it really gave me this embodied participation in our broader church life. And I started to sing more often, and there was a family quartet. As soon as I was viable, then my older brother and two parents made a quartet. So we did that. And it sort of tapped into the real lifeblood of our community, which was this mutual participation in the experience of faith. And that could be mostly extemporaneous, unplanned, emotional proclamations of truth, and that counted preaching and testimony, which were not dramatically different. One of them was slightly more based in the Bible. That was the preaching. The testimony didn't have that constraint. But both of them were very, like, emotive and yeah, they came from the heart on the spot. Musical performances kind of put a rhetorical and emotional frame around that, right? And the Holy Spirit used those musical experiences co-equally alongside personal testimony and preaching to kind of move people's hearts in ways that were mysterious but very impactful. And so for me, and I think really for our community, musical lyrics and rhetoric were pretty much entwined with the King James Bible as the language of faith. And so faith was church, was family, and music was holding it all together. So a little bit more about this music, and I've skipped the music history lesson. It says right here, music history lesson available upon request. So, but of course, there's some variation here, there's some diversity, but we did not really see a lot of variation. Much like we were the church, our songs were our songs, they were church music, that was God's music. Kind of all the same, where they came from, doesn't really matter. But my best attempt to get you inside some of this experience and what I was tutored into is just to give you some of these texts. And I imagine that you've probably never heard at least most of these songs. And the tradition, it'll probably sound maybe like some things you've heard, but it felt really, really specific to me. There's a body of churches that are doing this, but as a canon, it felt pretty confined to us, I think. I don't know. So I'm going to have folks read some texts that offer what I think is a decent overview of my childhood canon. And I've asked them to read aloud because I think it gives you a sense of what it might be to try and build a faith community around this rhetoric. And I want to point out that these weren't songs we sang sometimes. These were songs we sang all the time. And that elementary-aged Benjamin would have known all five verses by heart. So let's hear from these guys.
All right. I was burdened down with sin, no happiness I found within. I never knew the meaning of joy down in my soul when at last I finally knelt. Contentment filled my soul like I'd never felt. Heaven came down, there was glory all around when he saved my soul. I remember the day when the Lord saved me, all of heaven came down, I was happy and free. Glory filled my soul, for I knew the Lord had made me whole. I shall never forget the day when the Lord saved me.
The drunk on the street, the rich in their palaces, the poor and unlearned, the men of degree, they all have a soul in need of salvation, and they all have to come by Calvary. I'm so glad God saves old sinners. I'm thrilled and amazed how he sets them free. But the biggest surprise in redeeming old sinners is that he would save a sinner like me. Was I so wrong that I needed forgiveness? And was I so bad I had to be redeemed? Well, I wasn't a thief, but I lived in sin's prison, and I wasn't as lost as a sinner could be. And I was as lost as a sinner.
You will notice we say brother and sister around here. It's because we're a family and these folks are so dear. When one has a heartache, we all share the tears and rejoice in each victory in this family so dear. I'm so glad I'm a part of the family of God. I've been washed in the fountain, cleansed by his blood. joint heirs with Jesus as we travel this sod, for I'm part of the family of God.
Precious memories, unseen angels, sent from somewhere to my soul, how they linger ever near me, and a sacred past unfold. Precious father, loving mother, fly across the lonely years, and old home scenes of my childhood in fond memory appear. In the stillness of the midnight, echoes from the past I hear, old time singing, gladness bringing, from that lovely land somewhere.
We've wandered far from that old time teaching, from the path our Savior trod. Let us lay down our sin and get right with Him. Let us go back, all go back to God. Let us go back to the old time preaching. Let us take up our staff and rod, like Jacob of old, who went back to Bethel. Let us go back, all go back to God.
Tempted and tried, we're oft made to wonder why it should be thus all the day long, while there are others living about us, never molested, though in the wrong. When death has come and taken our loved ones, leaving our home so lonely and so drear, then do we wonder why others prosper, living so wicked year after year. Faithful till death, said our loving master, short is our time to labor and wait. Toils of the road will all seem as nothing when we sweep through the beautiful gate.
Oh yeah, okay, this is mine. Because if just one more soul were to walk down the aisle, it would be worth every struggle, it would be worth every mile. A lifetime of labor is still worth it all if it rescues just one more soul. That, I've chosen this verse because the rest of the song tells a different story, like keep working, because this was the only part we used, because, you know, I'll get to that in a minute. But these, I don't know, how many, anybody, any of these songs? A few? Like, some of them have some country music cred, like Farther Along, Precious Memories, yeah. There you go. So they have some sort of Americana type cred, but I think, I don't know. I didn't, these are certainly songs when I went to an evangelical college disappeared entirely, right? So they felt very marked to the place that I grew up in. So I want to do just a quick overview. This was the distilled truth of these songs to me. And I think in very many ways, these sort of texts were building that narrative for me. So there's a nature of supernatural reality in these songs that I think is probably fairly clear. It's a Billy Graham sermon in some respects, right? We're sinners in a sinful world. We're marked for hell. We've been gloriously rescued by the saving blood of Jesus, specifics on the blood part. And our immersion in that blood grants us an undeserved grace that reorients our lives. And it reorients our lives particularly around two moments. You've got salvation, which is momentary and happens suddenly, and it's incredibly momentous. It's like your whole life is different, and it's secure and effective. So we weren't Arminian that. We aren't going to lose our... Everything was... You were reordered, totally. Salvation did that. The other moment is the rapture. So Christ is going to return to abscond us to heaven. For us, that was before the worldwide judgment of the tribulation. It's also momentary, sudden, and it's momentous, changes everything. And it's certain and imminent. And this is like, I grew up hearing my family, well, the Lord may come back today, but if not, then... And that was not rhetorical. That was meant. So these two moments, they kind of put us between... We're sitting in between them, right? We've been joyously saved, but then we're waiting on the culminating joy of the rapture. And I think that's not super uncommon. I mean, there were plenty of people at the evangelical college I went to that would see that as familiar. What felt more specific to me was the rules of non-engagement that those songs kind of set up. And for that, it was... The key was we were redeemed people and we know how bad the world is. And since we know that, we can't feel at home in this world anymore. It's another song. And if we're living right, we'll be excited enough about salvation to want the same for other people, but we'll also be excited enough about a heaven to look over that and most other things. So there's some stark implications here. just to quickly lay them out. You had better be living right, because the pleasures and general approval of this world are kind of proof. If you like those things, you're, it's not good. And things are probably going to suck. What did you expect, right? Death, illness, social alienation, worldly lifestyle of your neighbors. That's par for the course. So don't whine too much about it. Old is good and new is bad. The devil is working, the devil, specifically physical, personal devil, is working pretty hard at making things worse, with more sin and more compromise. And if we want to keep our head right, you better be looking backwards when the things were simpler and folks weren't so confused, especially if you had a godly family, right? That's even better, right? And then the old time becomes a modifier for old time religion, Christian, altars, singing, preaching. Those are the things we need, and anything remotely new or up-to-date, technology, entertainment, ideas, education, they may be fine, but they've got a really high burden of proof. And then last of all, and I think this gets to this just one more soul sort of line, we should long desperately for revival, but we probably shouldn't expect it too much, because, you know, the millennium is out before us, and the world is getting worse. And we need God to revive our hearts, but honestly, it seems like a stretch because the world is bad, and purity is probably the better part of valor. If you can be pure or you can dramatically impact the world, you should probably focus on being pure. So the name of the game is a culture war, a la evangelicalism. We cared very, very little about sort of religious right politics because the world was getting worse, duh. And more than anything else, this orientation kind of defined our worldview. We were entrenching defenders, not offending world changers. That's the church Benjamin Hass grew up in. And obviously, if you take that to school, it gets awkward, right? If you take that to public school, even in the conservative town I grew up in. So I grew up kind of feeling marooned on the right of my very right small southern town, which is a very odd experience. And I want to give you one example that kind of locks that in, okay? So up until sometime in elementary school, there was a dramatic debate going on in our family whether it was okay for the four male children in my family. I had no sisters, thanks be to God for them, that were never born. Because we could not wear shorts, right? Why would you want to show off your legs, right? This was inherently immodest. It was problematic at any time of the year. Like, why would you? And so we'd never own a swimsuit because, of course, if shorts are not okay, mixed bathing, as in like women and men in the same body of water, not good, right? Whatever they're wearing. But so I remember very specifically being asked one time, because you go to school in shorts every day in like 95 degree heat or not in shorts. People start asking questions, and I was once asked, so wait, when you swim, do you wear swim pants? And it was a perfectly logical question. I think it was facetious in its intent, but it felt awful, right? Because it was just like I was really focused on this difference, and every once in a while that difference would be really pointedly noticed by someone else. And the culminating moment for this, the reason why I'm telling this particular detail, is that my fifth grade end of year celebration was like sports in the morning, is all day thing. We went to this park, sports, then we're going to give them lunch, and they're going to spend all afternoon in the pool, right? And I have no idea why, but for some reason, the compromise that was worked out was not that I would go for the first half of the day and go home, or not go that day at all, but I would participate in the full rewards of the day by going for the morning and then sitting in the afternoon with my father, who came to kind of hang around and support me somehow, in the grassy area next to the pool for 3-4 hours. And then field questions from people that knew he would come up and ask, wait, what did you do? And I didn't have any explanation for that, right? I didn't have a language to describe what. I mean, these are Southern Baptists, right? They don't have any imagination. So for that kind of thing, or in our view of, you know, the world as it exists, but anyway. So this kind of moment was the kind of thing I just spent waiting for, right? Things were fine. I had my little public school self, right? People call me Ben. It feels kind of like a different. And then every once in a while, it would just land. and I would just feel paralyzed. And I spent a lot of my childhood feeling like I was pretty much different than everyone else. It wasn't really true, of course. Like, we had to have a couple of Latter-day Saints kids I didn't recognize, right? There had to be some Church of Christ people that were feeling it. But for me, it felt incredibly isolating. And it felt like religion was why. And it meant I felt pretty empowered and safe at home and church and kind of haltingly trying to construct some other version of me that would hold up in another context. And I was always on edge about how these are going to collide. So that gets you through a lot of kind of the Benjamin Pass piece, right? So that pretty introduces you to a person who is very different than me. And, you know, it's probably pretty clear how high the bar for his success was and how very short I've fallen in terms of that bar. And conflict was inevitable. And so obviously, right, something wasn't going to work, but I ended up here, right? I didn't end up, you know, I'm not at a megachurch right now. I'm at a mess. Like, there's some real oddity to how far I made it, at least it seems to me. So I'll give you a quick, I'm going to speed up the timeline quite a bit here. So the first and maybe most impactful thing, and I've known this for a long time. It was funny how much it like stuck out to me as I prepared what I was going to say, is my mother was diagnosed with breast cancer when I was 11, and she died when I was 13. And to be quick and to be obvious, that reordered a lot of things for me, and dramatically so. Loss became the dominant story of my family and my church. She was very much beloved, and that was life for some time afterward. And there's this really odd and uncomfortable sense in which the most powerful and lasting impact of that story is not this one that my family's told, but the fact that it becomes a part of the story I'm telling you right now. Because one point, I think, though this has not been talked about, thankfully, but I think Benjamin, Ben, my family, anybody would agree that my mother's death was probably one of the primary events that make the rest of my story possible, or even plausible. I feel like in science fiction time machine terms, you take that event out and I probably just gradually disappear. I think that's 100% true. And my response and distance from my mother's legacy, at least in my family's terms, it's kind of a clear and unspoken measuring stick for the person that I didn't become. And it maps out the space between the Benjamin Hass, my mother raised and loved, and the Ben Haas, who really only has a vague relationship with the woman who died when she was really quite sick by the time I was 12. And there's really nothing left behind to contextualize that or complicate the static saintly woman that's been narrated to me for most of my life. And so this is hard, dense stuff, and it feels distant in some ways. I don't think about it all the time, but it is present, and I think it's a big part of the story. So fast forward through some things that happened very quickly, and then continually over the years after that event. My father takes the loss very hard, with a lot of consequences. Home life becomes about maintaining. This is not about training up children. This is about getting through the day. And my father's extended family is the one that fills the gaps so generously, lovingly. For a variety of reasons, my mother's extended family, who are more likely to be the guiding fundamentalist influence, are not the ones who pick up the slack, mostly geography. My older brother decides not to go away to conservative Christian college, but he starts dating the pastor's daughter very seriously, and so he's much more out of the picture, and he's mapped himself very neatly into the right way of doing things. So his relative absence, my father's grief, mean I grow up a lot. I mean, to give you a couple of ideas, I was the one that went to my father the first Christmas, I was in ninth grade, and said, you know what, I really want my younger brothers to have Christmas presents. I want to make sure that happens, because it wasn't clear that it was going to. And through a series of events afterwards, that goes so far as that my dad gets remarried very happily. When I'm a junior in high school, and for perfectly understandable reasons does not want to bring his wife back home to the house that they shared. So I remain in my childhood home at my father's offering, and he moves with my two younger brothers and his new wife to a new house, and I live on my own for 8 months as a junior in high school. Until I say, before I'm entering my senior year, I just feel like maybe I should spend my senior year, you know, at home with my family. And they thought, oh, well, that's great. Okay, he's still... So you get a sense now, like this Benjamin thing is like ramping up pretty dramatically, because the time I'm starting to date, drive, develop an independent social life, you got these two people who are fairly equal and at this point, highly distinct. One of them goes to church all three times a week, all the youth activities, sings at church, dates the right people, and it has really genuinely powerful religious experiences, right? Like I was in it in almost every way. But then I'm living in my own house, and I'm now consuming the media that I want, and I'm defining my own social life, and I'm thoroughly enjoying a normalized high school sort of existence, you know, high school band and like being a smart AP student, whatever. So there's some hiccups along the way that underscore the tension of all that, but mostly that's how I get to high school graduation, as this really oddly free agent. It's like that's kind of weird that happened. Free agent sets his sights on Cedarville University. They were happy enough to have me. My family and church weren't super happy about that. In the 70s, it would have been very similar to the college my parents went to. It had become much less so and more sort of like solidly conservative evangelical. They had the wrong version of the Bible, and they had worship music, and they were just concerned with like, what was it? The culture. What do we do with the culture? I've forgotten the catchphrase. Anyway, we were concerned about getting America back in a way my home church wasn't. So for me, it seemed like this perfect opportunity to craft an integrated self. Aha! I got like this plus this, divide by two, and I'm going to like fit. I'm going to dominate this place, right? I'm going to go in there. I know all the stuff. And just to sum up, it did not go nearly so well. I mean, Benjamin has got parachuted into an immersive evangelical subculture. I mean, many of you grew up in the sort of, they had the youth groups and the camps and the books and the praise music, and they knew different pastors than I did, and they went on mission trips, and they used an entirely different language to describe their faith, and none of that made any sense to either of the me's I brought into that situation. And so this 4 or 5 years at Cedarville are like kind of a prism, right? Depending on who's looking into it, it looks very different. I think Benjamin was having to like figure out, oh, wait, this is what other people think about how I grew up, and then, you know, I say now, like, that was $80,000 in 4 years on an education I'm ashamed of, right? Like, that's unfortunate. But then it's the place where some hybrid of those two met Amanda and started down the path that leads here. So I don't quite know what to make of it, but it's a time of a lot of stuff happening. So I'm guessing you can see when things are rounding the bend, and I don't think it was probably so easy through that 10 years as that version made it seem, even though there's a couple of hard pieces in there. But it could have been maybe in a different person's life very convenient to go to college and decide to be a different person and kind of move along. But there were a lot of skirmishes around like the difference between where I was from and where I was at. And I think I want to give you an entree into one of them. And it's around the King James Version. So the KJV was not just our version of the Bible, it was the Bible. And there's no time to explain the intricacies of how we crafted that argument, but it was the core of our belief and identity. And it was the boundary between who was with us and who was against us. And so I'm traveling back and forth from college, and this becomes really elevated in my home church. I don't know why it became such a big theme. I think I probably had something to do with it. I don't know if I was the primary cause. But this is it was a fairly intellectual tradition we were from. And so the effort that becomes the center of this, becomes this pamphlet. It's Can We Trust Our Bible? And I got a quote up here from it that I want to give you an idea of like where this is coming from. So this is the introduction. Just, you know, you open the page. All right. The following information is the result of much prayer. I am burdened about the drifting of the old-time way of loving and serving the Lord that used to be common among God's people. The devil hates the work of God, and he is busy trying to hinder or stop the work of God in our day. In my opinion, one of the most destructive tools he is using is modern versions of the Bible. What better way to hinder God's work and deceive people than to change the very word of God? The Bible says the devil can transform himself into an angel of light, 2 Corinthians 11:14. But that means that he will work in a way that appears to be right. I have completed this study not because I have an axe to grind. No. That was editorial. I have no one that I wish to attack, but I believe that there are many Christians who love the word Lord as much as I do, who are using modern versions of the Word of God. And I believe that many of these folks are simply deceived, and they have either been told that there is no difference between modern versions and the King James Version, or they have not been exposed to the truth. My desire is simply to reveal truth. And this is an amazing ending line. We will be held accountable for what we do with the truth we are exposed to. So, this is the book. I mean, I'm happy to let you look at it afterwards if you want to be really sad. Let me get back to where I am here. One Sunday with words that I do not remember, but in a moment I will never forget, this thing, I had studied it, I tried to make peace with it, I wanted to still be who I was and fit in, and my childhood pastor, the man who baptized me, the man who preached my mother's funeral, the most kind and conciliatory voice of a pastor I ever encountered growing up, he waved this pamphlet from the pulpit and made it clear that if you couldn't make peace with the truth here, then you couldn't help but be deeply questionable in terms of what your ultimate salvation was. And I imagine that he felt no ill will in saying that, and he probably felt the Holy Spirit guided him to do it. And I think he's a wonderful, generous man. But that forced a turning point in me, and it stands out even now as the climactic crisis of faith in my life, and it seems really stupid thing to be that concerned about, but the stakes were really clear, and you know, Amanda can tell you about the phone call afterwards, right? When I called her, and I was in severe doubt about our, like, at that point, what, 18 months long relationship? Like, I don't know if this is going to work because some weird stuff is really ramping up over here, and I don't know how we can, like, flesh these two versions of faith together because I just got shot down in my home church as an apostate, not by name, but clearly, like, there's 100 people, right? Like, how many of these people are like, I don't know about this book. So it was a huge moment. And so, of course, I had come way too far at that point to opt out and opt back into that sort of fragile logic. And the KJV piece then becomes, like, this integral piece of a brittle system that falls out, and then everything else seems kind of open. I knew in a real way there was no worth in still trying to be comfortable there because it was not an option anymore. And so I started to read and reconsider all sorts of things. It's like the 1 minute of 3 years. At that point, the escape was pretty certain. One question leads to another. Once you've learned from fundamentalists how bad evangelicals are, it's hard to really trust those people. So Amanda and I got married, and we moved across the country, and, you know, so I could start working on a PhD at a secular university, and that was totally off the map. And that landed us, oh, this is when we started pronouncing our last name Haas, right? So now you've got the person you know, and that trajectory landed us in Chapel Hill, and a few failed church experiences before that had us ready to try something as crazy as Emmaus Way was to us at the time. And I had some doubts about your apostasy, Tim. I really did. I felt, I But we were welcomed, and we found care and love and honesty and a beloved community, and the rest is history, right? Except in that version of the story, it starts to feel as if there's no room for Benjamin. And that hasn't bothered me a lot historically, but as soon as I agreed to take on this topic, I knew intuitively that to tell this story as a simple way out would be to tell it badly somehow. And I think I felt that because more often than not, I've spent the last several years telling it that way to myself, as if the reward for making it thus far was to finally not have to think so much about who I am and where I came from, and that I could just, you know, be myself for once. But in the end, I find that more often it ends up feeling like something I'm about to show you. I want to show you a scene from the 2005 movie Junebug. It's filmed in Winston-Salem, directed by a Winston-Salem native. It's about the oldest of two sons, George, who makes his way home to North Carolina. He's been away a long time. He's acquired a wife since then. She's British. While it's not identical to my experience, I do think it's the most autobiographical feeling thing I've ever seen on film. And there's a scene from the middle of this film where George and Madeline join George's parents and his brother Johnny and his sister-in-law Ashley, who's played by Amy Adams in a breakout role, at a church potluck. So I want to give you a piece of that. For me, that scene, I've not watched that film where that scene doesn't make me want to crawl out of my skin, because it's an experience I've had so many times, and if I were to go back home to my home church next Sunday, there's a 50% chance I would have pretty much that experience again. It's like, oh, you're home, when are you going to sing? And so you feel welcomed and celebrated, and you made to feel completely at home, except you're the person they're receiving, giving that welcome isn't really you, and you're suddenly ushered into this embodied awkwardness of being the person they still know and the person they'll never know, at least so it seems, and all the different versions of those people, they start to, like the brother who's like, he's not that happy, brother's home, right? And the wife's like, whoa, what? So all that stuff starts to happen at once, and as I hope my storytelling tonight makes clear, I can't find any way to talk about the journey that got me here without finding also the all sorts of ways that I never left. Because for better or worse, fundamentalists are the people that taught me how to sing and how to mean it, that what you feel and experience has everything to do with deciding what is true, that there's something powerful and beautiful behind, beneath, and among the seemingly mundane realities of our lives. That uniting ourselves in community with others is one of the best and only ways to get a glimpse of that bigger picture. And they would probably say that I didn't learn all those things well enough. But I am forced to admit to myself that I learned them just well enough that I can't seem to let them go. And if fundamentalism has taught me anything, it's how to be and feel and value being countercultural. And so the childhood I spent distrusting everyone on religious grounds, and undoubtedly a long list of social, racial, sexual, ethnic, economic grounds that I was never really taught to articulate properly. In the end, after much work, I'm on the opposite side of that fence. And as much as the people on the other side of that fence love me, there's no place inside there for me anymore. And I find it tonight deeply hopeful to have found a community where I am welcome, where my story is welcome. But I find it so much more hopeful to have found a community countercultural enough to articulate a welcome for all, a welcome that intentionally and indiscriminately holds a place at the table for Benjamin Haas, Ben Haas, Ben Haas, somewhere in there in the middle, for the folks and the family I left behind who wounded me, and for the many more entirely unspoken tonight for the most part, that I myself wounded along the way. And for all those who I spent decades imagining would never be welcome in any faith community ever. So when music majors start checking each other out, they trade albums. And the first album Amanda ever loaned me was Over the Rhine's Good Dog, Bad Dog. which I think was life-making for her. And for me, I found it compromising Christian hipster posturing at the time. And so poised on the cusp of a journey he knew little about, Benjamin Haas still found something moving in that, but I hope that Ben Haas understands it a little better. What a beautiful piece of heartache this has all turned out to be. Lord knows we've learned the hard way, all about healthy apathy. And I use these words pretty loosely. There's so much more to life than words. There is a me you would not recognize, dear. Call it the shadow of myself. And if the music starts before I get there, dance without me. You dance so gracefully. I really think I'll be okay. They've taken a toll these latter days. So I'm grateful for a dance that started long before I could imagine a way to get there. And I'm grateful for those who loved and yet love a me they don't quite recognize, and who somehow taught me to listen for the music that would lead me here. And I'm grateful for a community that welcomes all into a new and unexpected dance that makes healthy apathy seem okay and heartache beautiful. And I'm grateful to be just okay enough to keep awkwardly dancing for those who are still far away and to hold a space for all yet to come. Amen. So I think the idea was to do this confession and absolution tonight in voices from the community, because in many ways it felt like if those first set of songs told a story, these were telling an alternate story. I'm not sure it's going to make a ton of sense to do that with kids bopping around the room, but I'm going to invite Molly up to like sort of guide us into the table.
Thank you, Ben, for sharing your story from Benjamin Haas to Ben Haas, and for inviting us into that space. What if, for those of you who are numbered, my one through sixers, what if each of you just read one of your numbers that stuck out to you in your order for our condensed confession and absolution, starting with Dave Teason.
People get ready. There's a train coming. You don't need no baggage. You just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the diesels humming. You don't need no ticket. You just thank the Lord.
Lord, I've been trying to be what I should. Lord, I've been trying to do what I could. But each time it gets a little harder. I feel the pain, but I'll try again.
You can pick one, Joel.
Because everybody's got to have somebody to look down on who they can feel better than at any time they please. Someone doing something dirty, decent folks can frown on. If you can't find nobody else, help yourself.
If you still want me, please forgive me. The crown of love has fallen from me. If you still want me, please forgive me, because the spark is not within me.
And what is love? What is love?
So when he calls me, I will be able to meet my family at God's table. I'll meet my mother, my father, my sister, my brother. No more an orphan girl.
Thank you. I encourage all of you, don't recycle your bulletins. Take them with you and read these four parts of confession and absolution. It's really rich and moving, and for me, to think about Benjamin Haas and Ben Haas and how a thread of music has been so formative. And music, probably when we heard it right at the beginning and some of those verses, and thinking the loop that was started in Benjamin and so many of our heads, right? The loops that were started by lyrics and songs and hymns and doctrine that we were told growing up, and how Emmaus Way and Journey creates space for new loops and new hope and love and light to start again. For me, what stuck out, the one was, says, which I heard this in Emmaus Way, and it's been transformative for me. Shake off your shoes, leave yesterday behind you. Shake off your shoes, but forget not where you've been. Shake off your shoes, forgive and be forgiven. Take up your spade and break ground. And I thank you, Ben, for inviting us into what I think you have embodied, those lyrics and that truth tonight, as you have reminded us that we are not called to forget where we have been, but we are called to continually take up our spade and break the ground of our life, recognizing that we are who we have been, but we are also who we are yet to be. And for me, I think that's the invitation to the table tonight, and what Emmaus Way and our open table represents, is that every week we come to a place where we bring the Benjamin Haas of our life and the Ben Haas. And for some of us, it might not be as stark as that. And in the renaming, I did, Ben and I met earlier this week, I was like, oh my gosh, you're like Paul, you know, from Saul to Paul, from like, I mean, you were like renamed, right? I mean, how powerful that is, and yet how painful and what a journey sometimes that can be. And we all need spaces where we can bring the shadow of ourselves, we can bring our true selves, who we are wanting to be. We can come with the what has been and the garbage and the beauty of it, but also what is yet to come. A place where we can continually be reminded of who we are and whose we are. A place where we create space for the fundamentalist and the person who isn't really sure of anything at all. And so I encourage us tonight to come to this space that can hold all of it. For we hold one another, and God, through God's great love, holds us. So let us come to the table now to break bread and pour wine for one another. Emmaus Way, as you know, don't have to have a right doctrine. You don't have to believe the KJV is the only version of the Bible. You don't have to believe that, you don't care what you believe. Just know that you are welcome here. All of you, all parts of you. So come, let us break bread and pour wine.